Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 90. It's September 2nd, 2020. The existing community context is one that markets fear, assigns fault, and worships self-interest. This context supports the belief that the future will be improved with new laws, more oversight, and stronger leadership. Possibility thinking and associational life are marginalized, relegated to human interest and side stories in the media. The corporate model is the modern ideal, and the economy is the center story. The story in the stuck community defines the role of the media as framer of the debate. In community building, we need to realize that what the media reports is a reflection, not the cause of the conversation that citizens currently hold. To create a new story, we first need to come to terms with the current one. This begins by naming it. The story of the stuck community can be heard both in the dominant public debate and also in what we talk to each other about each day. It is important to understand that there is a hidden agenda in every story. This agenda is a point to be made, a political belief about what is important that stays constant regardless of the events of the day. The overriding characteristic of the stuck community is the decision to broadcast all the reasons we have to be afraid. This is a kind of advertising that exploits the fear we have of violence, of the urban core, of terrorism, of African Americans and other ethnic groups, of immigrants, of those who are poor and uneducated, of other religions, of other countries. It seems like the lead story of every local evening newscast is about crime and human suffering, and if our city had none that day, then we hear how somewhere else in the world someone was murdered, bombed, killed in an accident, or abducted from what we once thought to be a safe place. What we are hearing is the marketing of fear. In the telling, we are willing to sacrifice the wholeness and dignity of a person for the sake of capturing the emotion or drama of the moment. The marketing of fear thrusts a microphone in the face of someone who has just suffered an irreplaceable loss and asks, "How do you feel?" It is the commercialization of suffering for the sake of profit. Not that complicated. The marketing of fear is not just for profit. It also holds a political agenda. Fear justifies the retributive agenda, fundamentalist in the extreme, that has been on the rise for some time. The retributive agenda believes that a just and civil society is one that gives priority to restraints, consequences, and control, and underlines the importance of rules. It gets packaged as spiritual values, family values, the American way, love it or leave it, all under the umbrella of law and order. It helps build the incarceration industry and the protection industry. It creates a platform so that those in power can expand their power, and it discounts the rehabilitation industry. Fear forms the basis of our recent foreign policy and drives much of our legislation. Fear also fuels the allure of suburban life and is a subtle but clear argument against diversity and inclusion. In addition to marketing fear, the stuck community markets fault. When there is a human tragedy, most of the energy goes into finding who was to blame. There is a retributive search for responsibility and a corresponding defense from the players claiming their innocence. Fault marketing rests on the belief that if we can assign blame and find cause, it is useful to society and somehow reassures us that it won't happen again. To me, this is irrational thinking. What is missing here is a recognition of the complexity of human affairs, an acknowledgement of the paradoxical and accidental nature of life. There is no insurance policy against the human condition. Out of the decision to dwell on fear and fault, the community is stuck in a context that holds the following. We are a community of problems to be solved. Those who can best articulate the problems and who can best articulate the solutions dominate the conversation. The future is defined by the interplay of self-interests, dependent on the accountability of leaders, and controlled by a small number of wealthy and powerful people, commonly lumped into the category we call they. Community action is aimed at eliminating the sources of our fear. We aim at a set of needs and deficiencies. In order to eliminate our fear and respond to the neediness of our people, we try harder at what we have been doing all along. We lock down neighborhoods, build more prisons, and reduce tolerance to zero. We call for better programs, more expertise, more funding, better leadership, stronger consequences, and more protection. We are committed to trying harder at what is not working. When something goes wrong, we carry the illusion that after we find the guilty party, some kind of legislation or change in policy will prevent the crime or accident from happening again. We are stuck in the belief that we can legislate the future in mandate morality. All right, this is a little bit from a interesting book called Community by Community, The Structure of Belonging by Peter Block. And I'll read a couple of, just a short passage from an earlier section as well. The key to creating or transforming community, then, is to see the power in the small but important elements of being with others. The shift we seek needs to be embodied in each invitation we make, each relationship we encounter, and each meeting we attend. For at the most operational and practical level, after all the thinking about policy, strategy, mission, and milestones, it gets down to this. How are we going to be when we gather together? What this means is that theory devolves down to these everyday questions out of which community is actually lived. Whom do I choose to invite into the room? What is the conversation that I both become and engage in with these people? And when there are more than two of us together at the same time, how do we create a communal structure that moves the action forward? It is in these kinds of questions that accountability is chosen and care for the well-being of the whole is embodied. Individual transformation is not the point. Weaving and strengthening the fabric of community is a collective effort and starts from a shift in our mindset about our connectedness. Social fabric is created one room at a time. It is formed from small steps that ask, who do we want in the room, and what is the new conversation that we want to occur? In community building, we choose the people and conversation that we produce, that will produce the accountability to build relatedness, structure belonging, and move the action forward. A series of core insights informs us how to answer these questions. These insights include ideas on focusing on gifts, on associational life, and on the way all transformation occurs through language. Also critical are insights about the context that governs the conversations and the willingness to speak into the future. Two additional strands in the fabric of community explored here are the need for each small step to capture a quality of aliveness and the need for it to evolve in an organic way. There is an established method for accomplishing this aliveness that values all voices in the room, uses the small group even in large gatherings, and recognizes that accountability grows out of the act of co-creation. The essence of creating an alternative future comes from citizen-to-citizen engagement that focuses at each step on the well-being of the whole. All right, that's just a little sampling in actually three different parts of this book. Again, very interesting book. I'm not sure I've internalized all of it, but it's got me thinking. Obviously, some of you who are listening are part of the regulars, the group that's been gathering at Mozart's in Austin for years and years, decade plus. Some of you are just friends I know from other places, and who knows who else might be listening. But community and community structure and all that's on my mind, has always been on my mind. I mean, partly that, you know, why I even started corralling the regulars in the first place. I try to keep it as structure-free as possible. There's no agenda. There's no filter. There's no speakers. It's a circle. It's simple. It's basic. Come hang out and have coffee. We're going to be here every Friday. You need any help? Come on down. Want to be heard? Have an idea? Have something you're struggling with? Just come down. Let's see what happens. That kind of thing. I have to say though, I find some of this really interesting. Like this writer, Peter Block, spends a lot of time in this book talking about conversation and the words we use. And there's some loaded phrases in here. And by the way, as with all these dispatches, like this is all interrogative. This is not declarative. I'm exploring here. It seems like there's a forest over there that goes up into hills, into mountains, and maybe we can get our way through there by walking together. It's that kind of thing. I'm not coming off the mountain with revealed wisdom. That's not the way this is. But it's got me puzzling. So he mentions, you know, he seems to impugn, in my opinion, he's kind of making a few knocks at suburbs and corporations. But he's also making knocks at we think that the answer is just the right legislation, the right policy, that we're going to have the right people have the right conversation, they're going to come to the right decision, it's going to fix everything. That's incredibly in line with Wendell Berry and John Taylor Gatto. If you want to go find these tags here, I've read some of their stuff. Wendell Berry in particular has this great piece, Think Little, and also just some off the cuff remarks he made about last words and small groups, small solutions. He is skeptical of the big solution to the big problem. And here Peter Block is even sort of resisting the notion that communities exist to solve problems. It's a different kind of thing. In a way, all of this, walking through this, just as you're listening and just glancing at this material, you may be a super expert in this, have read the book and know many others related to it. You may do tons of community work, or, you know, you might just be like all regular people who have communities you participate in and that kind of thing and think about it from time to time. Either way, with things like, with what Peter Block is talking about here, it reminds me, in a sense, you remember when that meme went around of, here's the dress, is it blue and black or is it white and gold? One of those kinds of things where you can see both. Some people see one, some people see the other, and you just become convinced that, no, it's blue and black. And it's kind of uncanny how you might be leaning in when you first see the image. You can, it affects what you see when you actually get there and really, really look at it. And so when I hear things like, you know, a knock against corporations or something, or the profit motive or self-interest or what have you, it's tricky. He does mention, he does use, you know, he's very helpfully putting on the table, like, this is paradoxical stuff. One of the things I would say, I think, is almost like a defense of the corporation, a defense of capitalism, a defense of markets. I think there's a misnomer that travels around. The idea that what we see now, Wall Street equals capitalism, for example. The stock market equals capitalism, for example. Rigged games and this corporatist nonsense equals capitalism. And that's not the case. Fundamentally, it's important. Maybe we just need different terms now, different words. But there is a fundamental distinction. Is the system at play here fostered through choices made by individual actors, or are we coerced, mandated, required to do something? I like his notion, his introduction of the way you do this stuff, you want there to be aliveness, which is just an interesting noun unto itself, but you want there to be aliveness. That's a good one. I like the idea he mentions too, focusing on gifts, associational life, and transformation through language. But aliveness and things can evolve in an organic way. Now, a way for things to be alive is to use living people, like, and it can evolve in an organic way. That's how we all behave. I would just say that across society, then, to me, all tie goes to the runner in baseball. Tie goes to choice over coercion, where at all possible. If to you that means socialism versus capitalism or any of those kinds of things, so be it. I do feel the need to get back into the material of Eleanor Ostrom, her life's work. Just a very interesting perspective. I'll link to some cool talks and things in the show notes for this. regular.fm/90. And what she puzzled over, which is a really cool idea, was, you know, we're told that the way to organize resources, we have two choices. We can give it to these greedy individuals, corporations, this kind of thing, private self-interest, or we can centralize it, put it in a state bureaucracy and give it authority. And so we have these two choices, greedy capitalists and or inefficient and power mad bureaucrats. And she said, you know what, actually, let's go look in the world what's actually happening out there empirically. And she studied all of this, and she mapped it all out. You're hearing my dog waking up and shaking its collar. Good morning, dog. And so her work kind of shows there's a way through here. And she, in Peter Block sort of way, how he would describe it, she asked better questions and she went out looking for answers. So I think that's a really great thing to take away from this. And that I love the idea of communities come together and are defined by the questions that they ask. But, and by the way, one thing I'll come back to in the future is, just like in a way, a kind of silly defense of the corporation. Because after all, like, if you have an idea and you want to go change the world, go start a company. That's a totally legitimate, fair, authentic, cool thing to do. It doesn't have to be big, bad, evil. And by the way, capitalism, let me go back to this. Capitalism does not mean you must do what achieves the most profit. That is not capitalism. You have to do that if you take money from shareholders. If you take another person's money and the trade you make with them is you will go get the best return for their money, well, then yes, you do. But capitalism does not require you to do that. It doesn't. Those are not the same ideas. You can go form a sole proprietorship. You can go with sweat equity and all kinds of things, build something, figure out a way to do it without other people's money. And then you don't, then that doesn't come along for the ride. Capitalism does not mean you must go do every moment what makes the most profit. It means you, as a private individual, have distributed decision-making over the resources over which you are a steward. You get to make your own call. Coercive systems, and there's a whole kinds of varieties of coercive systems, remove that from the table. You're required to do something. You're forced to do something. So it's an interesting idea, and it reminds me too, like I see all the time people criticizing automobiles, and I get environmental concerns, and but I think it's important that we also put on the table when changing our mobility solutions, and there's all kinds of technology coming. The car is a fantastic liberator. The beatniks, you know, Jack Kerouac's On the Road. It's called On the Road. It's easy to forget the liberating ability of a federal highway system and a car. Load up your friends in a car. Where do we want to go today? We can go hundreds of miles from here. That kind of the freedom of the open road. Very classic. Again, I'm not saying, therefore, let's just pollute the world as much as we want. I'm not saying that at all. But just when I see people leaning only against these things without much depth or context, like Eleanor Ostrom is a sort of, she's such a great leading example of this. And Peter Block's introducing the idea of how about we ask better questions together. Hope y'all have a good one. Thanks, y'all.